Lawmakers in Springfield have adjourned for the week, but in the past 24 hours have created some movement on the state budget impasse. We'll fill you in, including whether Governor Rauner will sign a bill to provide $700 million in relief to social service agencies. A new Chicago Tribune investigation shows 200 public water systems across the state have had problems with lead in drinking water. And later,
I know the phone rang. You go, hey, it's Lee Bono. I said, hey, what's going on, man? I haven't heard from you since you were in high school. And you said, I want to thank you. I was flabbergasted.
StoryCorps founder Dave Isay joins us to talk about how stories like that one inspired his latest book, Callings, The Purpose and Passion of Work. Also, we'll help you identify the migrating birds you've seen around this time of year. And how are Cubs fans coping without the misery? That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's a busy news day this Friday the 13th here in Illinois with what appears to be initial steps towards a potential proposal on the state budget and a bill to fund social service agencies that haven't been paid in nearly a year. In about 10 minutes, we'll also hear about a new Chicago Tribune investigation into lead in our drinking water. In the past decade, dozens of areas, including in McLean, Peoria, and Champaign counties, have reported lead levels that would trigger action under federal rules. We're going to be talking with one of those reporters. But first, let's start with our Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief, Amanda Vinicky. She's joining us from the Capitol in Springfield. Hey, Amanda.
Hi there, Nyla.
Lots going on in the past 24 hours with the state budget. Now, just to set the context, of course, it's been 11 months with no budget and there's not a deal yet. But what happened yesterday?
Well, you had money go to the governor's desk that would fund these social service agencies that have been caught in this stalemate. So $700 million, that would be enough to bring them to not even half, but 46% of what they would typically receive. And that's emergency cash that they say could keep them afloat, maybe reverse some cuts or ward off further ones, either of staff or programming. But, and there's, of course, a but, while Republican legislators voted for it, the governor's office is signaling he might not sign that into law.
Okay, so what he has signed into law is stopgap funding for higher education. We saw that a couple weeks ago, but this $700 million, this is for social service agencies. That one's looking less likely.
Well, he says that there are, or the administration at least, some issues with how the actual language is drafted. And so it gets kind of technical, but basically they say that if, for example, the intent is to fund a call center at a helpline for seniors, that in fact the money to pay the phone bill isn't allowed because legislators tried to restrict where the spending would go. He said they wanted to make sure it went to programs and not, you know, any sort of administrative stuff. But the governor's administration is saying, no, it needs to be actually, we need to do some of the administration. It's tied into the programming. So it's technical.
Very technical. And it sounds like really, unlike with the higher education bill, the governor's really getting into details here and saying, hold on a minute, I don't think this is going to work.
Well, it's that, and I think it is more than that. However, that is the concern that the governor's office is most adamant about, but also giving hints that they believe stopgap temporary funding isn't what needs to be done right now. The priority should be a long-term, two-year resolution so that stopgap funding isn't necessary. And it also is, at the same time, the administration is pushing for more money that would fund, for example, get money to prison vendors, because they say that they're concerned about not being able to get that going and what that could mean. Will there become a public safety issue? Has it gotten to the point that we could have a, quote, you know, government shutdown, as you typically would expect without a budget?
Mm-hmm. Now, Amanda, there's some reports we've seen about rank and file lawmakers moving together. And we've seen a couple reports about this bubbling up over the past week or two about different committees forming to try to come up with their own solution apart from leadership to resolve the budget. Where are we at with that? What happened with that yesterday?
Well, apart from leadership, but nonetheless with the sanction of leadership.
Okay, good. This wasn't, that's a good distinction. Right.
But, and the governor's office was involved. So it's been described as a framework. If and when there is any sort of deal, this is a starting point for what a budget could look like. And as really has been expected, this isn't a shocker, that would involve both cuts, and you're looking really at Medicaid, and also when you're looking at revenue, there would be some sort of basically fiscal tricks like forgiving interfund borrowing or what have you. But really, what it gets down to that matters, I think, to listeners would be, of course, taxes.
And that's what I was going to ask. Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot about this graduated income tax. Is that part of this framework?
No graduated income tax can't be, because that didn't get on the ballot. It wouldn't have been an option right now anyway. It would have to actually change the Constitution. But at least until 2018 at the earliest, a graduated income tax dependent on income won't be part of it. Instead, what it suggests is really the only option when you look at an income tax, and that's an across-the-board increase that would bring right now what is a 3.25% income tax rate up to 4.85%.
Lots going on in Springfield. Amanda Vinicky, as always, is on top of it. She's our IPR State House Bureau Chief. Amanda, I know you'll be working all weekend, and actually you're going to be on the show on Monday, and you can tell us everything that you did over the weekend.
We'll talk again. Great. Thanks, Nyla. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too. You're listening to The 21st. The Flint water crisis in Michigan has put a spotlight on the issue of lead in our drinking water, and a new Chicago Tribune analysis out yesterday gives us concern for our state. It shows 200 public water systems across Illinois have had problems with lead in drinking water at least once in the past decade. What problem? Well, since 2004, dozens of areas, including McLean, Peoria, and Champaign counties, reported lead levels that would trigger action under federal rules. Joining us on the line to talk about this is Tribune reporter Michael Hawthorne. He's in Chicago, but hey, he's an Urbana native. Hey, Michael, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks. Great to be with you.
What's going on with lead in drinking water across the state, or particularly the analysis that you guys did?
Well, I was particularly interested after federal officials, you know, they were stung by really sharp criticism for not acting quickly enough in Flint. In Michigan, the blame has mostly fallen on the governor there and his emergency manager and the steps that were taken, the cost-cutting steps that were taken that led to widespread damage of the water distribution system in Flint, and therefore elevated levels of lead in a number of homes. In other states like Illinois, we've got a different problem. We just have a lot of lead service lines, and those are the pipes that connect water mains to homes. There's a recent report out from the American Water Works Association, which is the lobby chief trade group for water utilities around the country. Illinois has more of these lead service lines, by their estimates, than any other state, by far, actually, over 730,000.
So given that, right, should people be concerned? How are we testing for this?
Well, that's a great question right there. I think there are a lot of people debating this right now. I think this is an issue like a lot of other environmental issues, and especially issues that deal with lead in particular. In many respects, we think that we solved this problem a long time ago. Children aren't dying of lead poisoning like they were in the 50s and 60s. But there's still a lot of lead in our environment, in particular lead-based paints in older homes, and also these lead pipes. And so for many years, the U.S. EPA has allowed water systems to add chemicals to their water supply that are supposed to form a protective coating inside water pipes and therefore prevent lead from leaching into our drinking water. But a lot of study in recent years, Washington, D.C., Flint, also here in Illinois and Chicago, have shown that that treatment does not necessarily work. And what makes it more confounding and confusing for ordinary folks is that it's not predictable. So you could have one home that has really high levels on one day and not very high levels another day. And what makes this also so concerning is there's a widespread understanding that there's no safe level of exposure to lead.
Mm. And now when we're talking about the levels of exposure, you found that 90% of the homes have lead levels that are below federal standards. So that means, is a state required to take any action at that point?
Well, there's a really complicated formula that seems too complicated to probably most lay people, where communities are allowed or water systems are allowed to test a set number of homes every year or sometimes every 3 years. So Chicago, we have more lead service lines than any other city in America, but the city's only required to test 50 homes every 3 years. And essentially that's designed to figure out if this anti-corrosion treatment is working. And what they do is you don't face a regulatory you don't exceed the regulatory limit unless the levels are above this arbitrarily chosen 15 parts per billion.
Oh, so that's arbitrary.
10% of the homes. Yeah, that was set in the 1990s, not really because it was a protective level, but because people at the time in the water industry and in the EPA thought that most water systems could easily meet that standard.
Hmm.
It's not a protective measure.
So does that standard, yeah, or does that maybe lack of standard, as someone who's covered this issue, does that give you concern in terms of?
Oh, definitely. And we face this in a number of areas right now where standards have not been updated based on the science. Another one that affects a lot of people is the amount of acceptable lead in dust. If you're cleaning up a home of you know the dust from lead based paint, the current what they call clearance standard is a lot higher than it should be based on the science. So in this case, what Flint is really drawing out, what places like Galesburg, Illinois are drawing out, is this chronic and intermittent problem with lead in our tap water. We haven't really tested widely. That's going to change probably based on what the federal government is telling the states to do and what the states are telling the local water utilities to do.
Michael, the Tribune report that you, obviously that you were looking into, that you wrote, includes an interactive map of Illinois where you can see which areas had the highest number of incidents of exceeding federal standards for lead in drinking water. Those you just said, we're not really sure how important those standards are. But just that report, by the way, we will tweet that link out. If you follow 21st Show, 2NST Show on Twitter, we'll put it up on our Facebook page as well so people can see that. But Michael, can you tell us historically which areas have had the most issues throughout the state of Illinois apart from Chicago?
Wow. I mean, number one would be Galesburg, in part because they've tested a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
So Knox County is
right
northwest of Peoria.
Right, and certainly that's a problem they've been dealing with. Right.
Mm-hmm. I think the feds were sharply criticized for not getting involved quickly enough in Flint. They looked around at the tests that had been done over the years in the Midwest in general, and Galesburg really stuck out. And it's really intermittent there. Some years they've complied with the federal standards, some years they haven't. They've gone about and actually replaced lead service lines in about two-thirds of the community. This problem keeps coming up in the other one-third.
Is there a requirement which somehow gets triggered that you have to replace the lead service lines? Because we know, for example, in Chicago, it's too expensive, and we don't know if they're able to do that. And, of course, that's the problem in Flint as well, the cost of replacing these lead service lines.
Right. And so the ultimate goal of an independent advisory board of the EPA included last year is that the ultimate goal should be replacing these lead service lines altogether. And also that's what the position now is of the drinking water utility lobby. And you get to at the real conundrum there is the cost of this. And,
mm-hmm.
and also there are some pretty thorny legal issues. Who owns the lead service line? So in Chicago, for example, and in a number of other communities, the local plumbing codes required the use of lead pipes up until the mid-80s or at some point in time. But under those same local laws, the individual homeowner is responsible for a good number of or a good amount of those lead service lines. So who's supposed to pay? Some communities, Boston, Massachusetts, Lansing, Michigan, Madison, Wisconsin, they've already addressed this in one way or another, oftentimes with some kind of incentive program where the local utility will pay a certain percentage or a few thousand dollars of the cost. At this point, what happened in Galesburg, as I think you've talked about on your show, is the EPA said anybody with an individual test level above this 15 parts per billion figure should be getting bottled water or a water filter. And it kind of gets to the ultimate advice for anyone is at this point, if you're concerned about this, and you probably should be, especially if you're thinking about getting pregnant or if you have young children, you should be getting a certified lead filter and drinking your water through that filter.
Well, and those lead filters can be installed. People can individually install those, as opposed to what you're thinking about in terms of having whether or not you know whether or not the testing is there, because that's a whole other conversation I know we could talk about for half an hour about the testing and if that's accurate.
Sure.
What your recommendation is for people who are concerned is to get these lead filters installed, do you think, personally in their homes?
Yeah, it's not mine. That's what the EPA's recommendation is.
Okay.
What all the experts who have been studying this, the academics who have been studying this for a number of years, is because it's intermittent, because, you know, one morning you could have a high level and another morning you could have a lower level. I've learned a lot over the last year and a half about just how complicated actually drinking water treatment is, and then also just the distribution of our drinking water. It's something we take for granted. But what we're facing here is another consequence of actions that were pretty widespread in Illinois and around the country during the last century, when for a number of reasons that are beyond my understanding, we sure introduced a lot of lead into our environment, and it doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense when you study history and you realize that might have been one of the things that led to the downfall of the Roman Empire. That we knew, you know, at the beginning of the last century, in modern understanding of the dangers of lead, we knew what kind of problem that this element could cause when we're exposed to it, and yet we used a lot of it for a long period of time.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's Michael Hawthorne. Michael and his colleague Jennifer Smith Richards reported that story, that latest investigation by the Chicago Tribune about 200 public water systems across Illinois. Again, we'll tweet the link out to the whole story as long as with the Tribune's interactive map so you can check out your area. Michael, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, StoryCorps founder Dave Isay joins us to talk about his latest book. It's called Callings, the Purpose and Passion of Work. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Why we do what we do with our work is the subject of the latest book by StoryCorps founder Dave Isay. It's called Callings, the Purpose and Passion of Work, and he's going to be speaking on this on Sunday afternoon in Chicago as part of the Chicago Humanities Festival, Our Cities program. He'll be at the Feinberg Theater on Sunday afternoon, but he joins us now to talk about the book. Hey, Dave, welcome back to Illinois, at least virtually right now.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Yeah, it's great to have you on, Dave. You know, I learned a lot about your calling while reading this, and I didn't know that initially you were planning to follow in family footsteps, and instead of starting StoryCorps and being a journalist, you were going to go to medical school?
Yes, I was going to be a psychiatrist like everybody else in my family. Over the course of like a crazy 24 hours where, basically, I tripped over a story that I thought was kind of an amazing story about these two recovering heroin addicts who had this dream of building a museum to addiction before they died of AIDS. They both had AIDS, and this was in 1987 or 1988, met these two in a store that they ran, and they showed me these models of this museum they were planning to build. And blueprints of every floor and of every exhibit. And it was just an incredibly moving, beautiful thing to see. And these two had really the courage of their convictions and were phenomenal people. And they had these letters from, that they had written to every rich person they could think of asking for money, which were just, you know, form rejection letters from people. Even Donald Trump was around even back then, believe it or not. They read these letters as hopeful, even though they were, you know, clearly they weren't going to get money for this thing. So I started calling all the, in the yellow pages, which they used to have back in the old days, I started calling all the TV stations in New York and pitching the story, and no one wanted to do it. And I started calling the radio stations and a community station here in New York. They all said no until I got to a community station. And the news director, who's a woman named Amy Goodman, said, it sounds like a good story, but we don't have anyone to do it. Why don't you do it?
As in the Amy Goodman, right?
The Amy Goodman, yes.
Okay, just to be clear to everybody.
Right. That's right. And I went and took a tape recorder, and, you know, I had that moment. I was, you know, I'm thankful every day that when I was 21 years old or 22, it was that, you know, I had that moment when I pushed record and play on that tape recorder and they started, you know, talking. I knew this was what I was going to do for the rest of my life. And then someone from NPR happened to be hear it that night on BAI and picked it up and withdrew from medical school. So that's kind of a crazy hit by lightning story.
Well, and I love that story, though, Dave, because I think it's a moment. And I had a moment like that when I was 14 and I was watching TV news of Nelson Mandela being freed from prison. And I remember this very clearly, like watching him put his fist up in the air and thinking, that is what I want to do. I want to be there and I want to be a journalist. And I think you and I both had these moments of clarity of this is what our calling is. But do you think this book is maybe for stories for people who haven't had that clarity? Because there's lots of different ways people have fallen into different careers as you hear the different stories.
And what you see in this book, some people have that moment. Some people don't have the moment. But everybody who's in this book, are doing work that's incredibly meaningful to them. Some people have the moment much later in life. You know, there's a woman in this book who's, working in a Dairy Queen and cleaning dentist offices. And, you know, she's a single mom, raised four kids, and she's putting one of her kids into college. And out of the side of her mouth, you know, she says to the registrar, like, I wish I could go to college. And the registrar said, and I'll help you. And she signed up for a science class. She thought she was terrible in science, and the only one that she didn't know what it meant was anthropology. And she looked it up, and it said the study of, you know, humankind. And she was like, that sounds interesting. And she went to her first class, and she was like, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And so it can happen anytime. I think, you know, what StoryCorps is, because of, you know, it's this massive oral history project. About 250,000 people have participated now across the country, either being interviewed or interviewing a family member, a friend, a loved one, a stranger. And it's essentially, you know, what we're doing because of the nature of what happens in the booth is collecting the wisdom of humanity. And this is really, you know, wisdom about work. And I think whether you found your calling or you haven't found your calling, you know, what we try and do on the radio every Friday is create these little kind of poems about, you know, about life that shake you on the shoulders and say, like, this is what's important. And in the same way, you know, these on the page, these are sort of little, you know, written poems of everyday people who don't often get celebrated or thanked or a lot of love for the work they do, nurses and teachers and social workers. Stories that shake you on the shoulders and say, like, this is what work is all about. This is why,
and I love how
you get up in the morning to do your job.
Yeah, and I love how, by the way, we're speaking to Dave Isay, and we're talking about StoryCorps, but also this book about people who had these moments when they found their calling. For those of you listening, if you want to join us and share that moment, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet them to 21st Show. And, Dave, what I'm thinking about that is you're talking about this. I mean, so much of this book has iron workers and AIDS hospice nurses and all of these different careers. But
right.
I love how you put bridge workers and sanitation workers, you know, garbage collectors into your section on healers. And you had the neurosurgeon in your philosopher section. And I wondered how much of this was also about breaking down stereotypes we have about different jobs. And I'm thinking about how much of this maybe comes from your inspiration of the great oral historian Studs Terkel from Chicago and his book Working.
Well, I should say that one of the perks of working at it's Studs Terkel's birthday is on Monday, but at StoryCorps we actually have a holiday every year. We do it on Friday. It's a day off at StoryCorps today in honor of, so we have Studs Terkel Day.
Oh, that's
so
great!
It's a
happy Studs Terkel Day to you.
On Studs Terkel Day, yes. Which is why I'm happily like in a pair of shorts and not in my suit. You know, it's a great day in honor of Studs. He had a huge, you know, influence, and I do think that it's a radical book. You know, the message to young people, to kids, to all of us, you know, kind of in the ether is to do to make as much money as you can as fast as you can and retire, and that's the dream. And the message of this book is that there's a much more rewarding dream, which is to take risks and work very hard and live with integrity and find a work, find a path to doing work that, that matters deeply to you. One of the things about it, it definitely does break down stereotypes. I mean, one of the things I love about StoryCorps, you know, on the radio, and it's true in this book as well, is that, you know, when you hear a voice of someone, any preconceived notions you have based on what they look like, you know, you're just wide open to hearing someone's story. And in the same way with this, in this book, you don't see people's picture until the end of
the story. I was going to ask you, is that why the pictures are at the end? Okay.
You got it. There is, the sanitation workers who care so deeply about their work and have such an impact on their community. I mean, I think in the spirit of Studs, I mean, that they do incredibly, incredibly valuable work. And the bridge
workers who are talking people off of bridges. And you don't think about the fact that people who work on bridges spend a lot of time noticing and identifying people who may be trying to commit suicide and do a lot of care and psychiatric and psychological care of people in that way.
And I think it also, you know, there's a lot of, you know, StoryCorps in some ways, you know, we've talked about this before. It's the opposite of reality TV. You know, no one comes to get rich. No one comes to get famous. It's really about love and gratitude. And there's a lot of gratitude in this book. You know, there's the story of a neurosurgeon who has a patient who's got a tumor on his brain and can't speak, and he's making small talk with the guy's wife. And she says, like, why did you become a surgeon? And he starts talking about his eighth grade science teacher. The patient is there. He can't speak. And then he's operated on. He wakes up. He gets his speech back. And the first thing he says is, you need to thank that teacher. And the guy got on the phone and called his teacher and thanked him. And this was a conversation between the two of them talking about that conversation. It's a reminder to thank the people who've helped you.
Yeah, that's a great reminder. We actually played that at the beginning of the show. So people who were listening at the beginning, that was a moment from there. Dave, I wanted to ask you, as you're thinking about these stories of gratitude, the story behind why you did this book. My favorite story was actually Rose Brudno. Is that how you say her name? The bar owner who...
Yeah.
I love how this...
She passed away, yeah.
Yeah, she just... This really, she just was like, I needed to support my family and I wanted to get away from my abusive husband. So I opened this bar and then I took care of everybody in this Ohio town. And even the drunks who... The alcoholics who came in on Friday with their paychecks, I would just take it from them and say, I'll give it
That's
back
right.
to you the next day. But you have a great, I wonder if you could share with us your story that you recorded with your family's OBGYN and prompted this.
That was kind of the inspiration for the book. When we were having our second kid, we had this OBGYN who was this amazing, just fierce woman. Her name is Austin Chen, Chinese immigrant. Tiny, but brilliant and straightforward and no nonsense and hilarious. And she had made, I knew a little bit about her. She had made a pledge to her patients when she started her practice to deliver the baby of every one of her patients, to be there for her patients, which meant that, when she delivered our kids, she had been in, our second kid, she delivered both kids. She'd been in practice for 15 years. And had worked 365 days a year. She never had a day off, and she had never left Manhattan. I knew the story. She told me a story about how when her father was dying, that she went to see him to say goodbye, and one of her patients called, and she turned around and didn't get to see him and came back to be with her patient. Now, it's extreme, but she is a very rational person and a very practical person. And she said, I made this decision. It was my decision. This is how I wanted to live my life. And she's just extraordinary. And I had been lucky enough to be on the Colbert Report the night before an appointment with her. And we had the appointment at the end. She said, you know, I saw you on Colbert last night. I wish I had done something important enough with my life that I could be on that show. And I mean, I almost like fainted in her office. And I said, Dr. Chen, like if you took everyone who'd ever been on Colbert's show, they couldn't like reside in your pinky, you know? and she like was like, oh, what are you talking about? And, you know, threw me out of the office. And the day I was having lunch with my publisher and we were thinking about what the next book would be. And I told that story. And we were like, okay, we have to do something about, you know, about callings, about work. I should say, you know, I've been on book tour, and on the first night of the book tour, Dr. Chen, soon after she delivered Maisie, our little baby, stopped her practice in New York and moved to Appalachia to open a practice there and devote, you know, the next part of her life to serving people in a small rural community. And she actually drove to New York for this reading.
Wow.
After delivering a baby, came to the reading. My son, my older boy, was there and got to see her. And we celebrated, and then she got back in the car and drove back so she could be with her patient that night.
Dave, as you're talking about Dr. Chen, I'm thinking about another story in the book about a doctor and his daughter who also becomes a doctor. And the dad tells his daughter that now that she's a physician, she's so emotionally and spiritually fulfilled, he can see that in her all the time. And I wonder if this is about, if you think that there is a level of emotional and spiritual fulfillment that can probably really just come from your job and what you do.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I think you asked me before about whether this is for, you know, people who have found their calling or haven't found their calling. And, you know, the lesson of the book, I think, and you know, and I think it's important to listen. You know, we've done, this is the largest collection of human voices. And I said, it's kind of the wisdom of humanity. And, you know, you got to listen to what's in this stuff. And it's the same kind of lesson over and over again. And you hear the last three words in the book, and I don't think I'm giving anything away, are a grandfather, 93-year-old, he's since passed away, with his granddaughter talking about how he was supposed to, you know, he was expected to grow up and work on his parents' dairy farm and did something else. And she said, what advice do you have for me? And he said, you know, live with courage. I think that's the message of the book. And there is this kind of voice, I think, inside of all of us that we need to listen to and, you know, kind of put out what society expects of us and put out what, you know, family, friends, or parents think we should do. A voice that knows what it is we're meant to do. And the lesson is to kind of listen to that voice and do everything you can, fight with all you've got, no matter how long it takes to do that thing that's your calling, that you're really, really good at, that you feel like you were put on this earth to do, whether it's, you know, sanitation, working in sanitation, or being a doctor, or taking care of kids, your kids.
As you say that, I wonder if you feel like, as you collected all of these stories, if you feel like there was a common wisdom or if it was different generationally, if you find that, I'm thinking about maybe grandparents' generations versus kids who are going into or college students who are graduating today. Do you think that there's a difference in the way that we've looked at our jobs over the past couple of decades? I wonder if you heard that from people.
No, I mean, I think what it's interesting that StoryCorps, like no matter the age, you know, no matter the where it's recorded, big towns, small towns, across kind of political divides, the lessons are often very, you know, similar. I mean, I think that in many ways, like it's old people who have, you know, older or people who have experienced difficult things in their lives who are the keeper of wisdom. So, you know, I think that maybe what comes from an older generation is more informed by life and maybe wiser. But, you know, you have older people and younger people in this book and the message is very similar. I mean, I think that the pressures that were on people, and again, the messages, as I said earlier, kind of in the ether about what's important in terms of work have changed over the years. But the importance of listening to that voice inside you that I was talking about, of, you know, having real clarity about what you're, you know, what you're meant to do in life, just doesn't change at all, depending on age. In some ways, I think it's, again, you know, you think about...
Dave, I'm sorry. I'm afraid we're... Now. Yeah, thank you for that, though. I appreciate it. That's Dave Isay. He's speaking in Chicago this Saturday, founder of StoryCorps. Thanks, Dave.
Great to talk to you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Sandhill cranes, American golden plover, and even white pelicans can be spotted this time of year throughout Illinois as thousands of birds are making their way across our state. This Saturday is actually International Migratory Bird Day. Here to tell us more about local things about this event and what to look for this season in your backyard is Greg Lambeth. He's a birder and bird photographer. We're also joined by Chelsea Walsh, who's a public program specialist at the Champaign County Forest Preserve District. Chelsea, Greg, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thanks for having us.
Chelsea, so Saturday's International Migratory Bird Day. Why is it now?
The second Saturday of May is the International Migratory Bird Day. There's a international committee that chooses this day. It's the second Saturday in May because that's when migratory birds are moving and really easy to spot in this area.
And where are they moving from this time of year?
Mostly it's birds that have spent the winter in warmer areas, and they're moving north for their spring and summer breeding grounds and where they'll spend the majority of the year.
Greg, what kind of birds do you think we're typically going to see around central Illinois throughout the state this time of year?
Well, during the middle of May, a lot of our neotropical migrants start moving through, so we have large numbers of warblers, vireos, thrushes, tanagers, orioles, grosbeaks. It's really a long list of things that we can see. There are times when you can go out and see over 100 species of birds in a single morning of bird watching this time of the year. So for birders, it's really the best time of the year.
And if you've never been a birder and you maybe want to start, what tips do you have?
Well, I think it's always good to get out early in the morning. You know, I'm just walking out into your own backyard, seeing what's moving through your own neighborhood, just listening to what's singing this time of year. Most of our migrants are also singing. Going into any of the neighborhood parks that have large trees, the birds are, in most cases, they're hungry. So they've been flying for several hundred miles if they've been moving overnight. So they're going to be active and just keeping an eye out for what's around.
Are there specific times of day? I think I always hear, the 6 a.m. birds. But are there specific times of day we're going to specifically hear birds singing this time of year?
Well, this time of year, some birds will sing through most of the day. One bird that I would mention is a red-eyed vireo, and they're one of our migrants. They also breed in the area, and they will sing all day long. But most birds sing most actively during the mornings.
Chelsea, what draws birds to stop in certain places and not others, and where are good places you think people should go?
I think birds are mostly drawn towards places of water because, obviously, they can get their water. They're also looking for places that are sheltered. So if you're considering putting up your own bird feeders, you should also consider making sure that it's kind of sheltered and protected.
And by sheltered, you mean?
Protected by trees or shrubs, places for them to kind of hide from other birds that might
other
prey on
birds?
Them
okay.
Or animals that might prey on them. So
I wanted to ask you about that in a minute, but I wanted to first just ask you about the International Migratory Bird Day, the stuff that's going to be happening at Homer Lake on Saturday. What are you guys specifically going to be doing?
From 11 to 1, we will have a mist netting demonstration set up. So Tony Celis-Murillo, who's a postdoctoral researcher for the Natural History Survey, he's going to come out and set up nets. He's going to capture wild birds, band them, record information on their size and their weight, that sort of thing. So people will be able to get a chance to see wild birds up close from 11 to 1. And then from 1 to 4, we're going to have educational activities. We'll have crafts. There's storytelling from 2 to 3. We've set up a migratory obstacle course where people can pretend they're migrating birds and they have to get from point A to point B.
Well, I wanted to ask you about those obstacles, but the first thing about the mist netting, obviously something that should not be done by people trying to by people who are not trained in this.
Correct.
Okay.
There's a reason I'm not doing the mist netting.
I thought I should make that clear for everybody. But getting to what people can do, and Greg, I wanted to ask you about this as well. As Chelsea's talking about different obstacles or making sure that when you're setting up your bird feeders at home, what do homeowners, gardeners, what do people need to think about this time of year especially to create a welcome environment for birds?
Yeah, I think it's always helpful to have a variety of different kinds of plants. A lot of our migratory birds like to be down in some lower vegetation, so shrubs that are 6-8 feet high. They really do like to have some cover. There are certain species of hawks, like Cooper's hawks, that like to prey on small migrating birds, so that they like to have places to hide. I think it's also important to think about other kinds of predators in your own home, like cats.
I was going to say, if you're a cat owner, what should you do? Is this something, if you have an outside cat, you should be thinking about?
Well, what I would say is that there's really been a lot of research done in the last 10 years or so on predation of birds by cats, and it is significant. And I think so for homeowners to be thoughtful about their own pets and the impact they may be having on the natural bird communities.
How much of those are feral cats versus domesticated cats?
Both can be a concern.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then if we're thinking about, I think people know, like for monarch butterflies, like say plant milkweed, mm-hmm. if you're thinking about a particular bird, are there other things that you were talking about hedges, are there other kind of, there's other things you people want to think about?
I just think having a broad variety, some plants that flower, because that'll bring insects in. There are certain kinds of shrubs that have lots of caterpillars on them. These birds are in most cases eating bugs and insects and caterpillars. So anything that will draw in that kind of food supply for these birds would be helpful.
For both of you, for this time of year, what parks around Illinois do you like to go to for great bird watching? Chelsea?
Well, I'm going to be a little Homer here and say Homer Lake is a great place to come. The Interpretive Center has a bench set up in front of our bird feeders, so you can sit on the bench inside and look out our windows and watch the birds that come to our feeders. We get a great variety. We get orioles sometimes. We get woodpeckers all the time, cardinals almost every day, so that's a good place to start. Champaign County Forest Preserves, we also have nesting bald eagles at our preserves, so if you're interested in seeing eagles, that's a good place to start.
Greg, what about you? I know you don't want to give away your best locations, imagine, but what are other locations you can share with everybody?
I'm happy to share those locations. One of the real advantages of living in East Central Illinois this time of the year is that the birds really rely on these little pockets of habitat. And so any of the 5 forest preserves in Champaign County can be a really good place to look for birds this time of the year. My favorite by far is Crystal Lake Park. Crystal Lake Park is probably the best downstate park for seeing migratory birds. You've got the saline branch that runs through there. You've got some mature white oak stands. You've got a lot of understory kinds of plants and shrubs and stuff. It's just a fantastic place.
And what about in Springfield or Bloomington or further out?
I'm less familiar with those parks. I know there's I think it's called the Burwell Trail in Bloomington. I know there's a hike and bike trail that goes through normal Bloomington that can be really good. Birding anywhere along Lake Springfield can be good because there you've got the water that we were talking about earlier, as well as some forest habitat adjacent to the lake.
That's Greg Lambeth. He's a birder and bird photographer. Thanks also to Chelsea Walsh, Public Program Specialist at Champaign County Forest Preserve District. And again, that event for International Migratory Bird Day is going to be at Homer Lake on Saturday. We'll tweet all of that information out if you follow 21st Show. We'll have it up on our website, too. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
That's a sound Cubs fans aren't used to hearing. For those who have not had the pleasure of a Cubs game, that's what they play at Wrigley when the Cubs win. And you know, that song's already been played 12 times so far this year. The Cubs' overall record, 25-8, is the best in the MLB right now. It's baseball season, of course, and here at the 21st, we cheer for all Illinois teams. And I will note for Sox fans who are groaning right now, we know you were also in first place, but the Cubs do have the best record in baseball right now. And we know this is an unexpected place for Cubs fans, so we thought we would provide some psychological support for you on how not to live with misery We know it's hard. So on the line from Chicago is Amar Madhani. He's the Chicago correspondent for USA Today and a big Cubs fan. Amar, great to have you.
It's great to be with you. And that's such a great segue. I get to come into that music.
Yeah, of course.
I'm ready to go.
You're ready to go. You grew up in Chicago. What memories do you have growing up as a Cubs fan? Maybe not as happy as that music made you feel.
Well, you know, so I'm in my late 30s. And my, you know, my first Cubs game was in 1983, and the first good, I got a good, relatively good Cubs. You have to, with the Cubs, you have to put everything in relative terms. But I got my first relative good Cubs team in 1984, that appeared to be on the precipice of going to the World Series when I was about 7 years old. I remember, you know, one of my earliest sort of sports fan watching memories is watching Leon Durham. Let that ball slip through his Gatorade-soaked glove back in 1984 and everything fall apart in Game 5.
Oh, man. Right, and I think you wrote, I think this is a very typical of Cubs fans' experiences, right? And one of the reasons we wanted you to come on to the 21st today and talk about it is you're a USA Today Chicago correspondent, as we said, not a sports reporter, but you wrote a column about how this feels like a dream that you never want to awaken from. And I feel like I have to ask, do you feel even weird talking about it, like this is going to jinx everything?
Absolutely. Well, right after I wrote that column, they're 1-2 since
they lost. I was going to say, this hasn't been a good week. I know.
So, yeah, no, and then your producer was telling me Littleton the goat was bitten by a...
He was, and that's a note for our fans who thought that Littleton the goat was going to come on today. Unfortunately, he did get bitten by a coyote last night, but we're hoping he's okay. He's fine. He's just... at the doctor, and we'll be with us soon. Well, Littleton is...
And I feel like it's my fault.
It's your fault. And Littleton, for people who do not know, is a pygmy goat who resides during the school year with a University of Illinois student. And yeah, is someone who he thinks is reversing the curse. But do you feel like that this is going to unravel at a moment's notice? Or do you feel like the Cubs are finally at a place where... It was a pretty good year last year. It was a pretty good foundational year. Everyone kept talking about how last year was going to be the year. How do you feel about this year?
Well, I think last year felt like things accelerated far beyond what I was expecting. You know, I followed the team very closely, like a lot of fans, and I thought they were going to be a very good team. But yet last year was going to be a foundational year. That the idea of them making the playoffs and winning 97 games just didn't seem realistic. I would have never dreamed of that at the beginning of last year.
And now,
even going into this year,
right?
You know, I thought they're definitely, you know, a playoff team and a World Series contender. But coming off to the start that they have, you know, this is the best start that we've seen in the NL since the '77 Dodgers that lost in the World Series. It's hard to fathom a start like this, and you have to temper your expectations. I was at my parents' home the other day, and they moved to Chicago as immigrants in the early 70s, and my dad never has really understood why I spend as much time as I do.
Why you're such a big baseball fan.
Yeah, or in general, why Americans spend so much time obsessing about a sport, and particularly baseball, which he finds pretty boring.
Are they not big cricket fans? I feel like I should have.
No.
Okay.
No.
But that's a pretty good, it's a pretty good parallel, I would say. An
yeah,
obsession with
except,
cricket and an obsession with baseball.
But if you think baseball is slow.
that's true. Well, you know, I wanted to ask you, there's in the article you wrote about the Cubs' success this season feels a little bit like a salve in a city where too much is going wrong. What did you mean by that?
Well, and for me, so I spend most of my days writing and thinking about things that aren't all that great, and it's a tough time to be in Chicago right now, whether you're wherever you live in the city, but in certain pockets it's tougher, much tougher than others. You know, we're going through a financial crisis here. The city's pension funds are underfunded by $20 billion. Trust in the mayor is lost. We're on pace. I think we have 30 murders already midway through May. It's not even midway through May, and we're on pace for 500 through this year. The police department's in the midst of a Justice Department civil rights investigation.
So in all of that, which is all really serious and difficult, there is the one bright spot, which are the Cubs and the Sox.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, look, whatever way you find
I know
it,
maybe you're not going to acknowledge the Sox, but I felt like I had
to
throw that
in there. I will acknowledge the Sox. The Sox aren't my team, your sports team is like your family. I feel like it's sort of given to you, and you can't get rid of it. You're stuck with them. And so I'm stuck with the Cubs.
Well, it's a pretty good – I would say this is a pretty good year for the family reunion then. Let's leave it at that, right?
Absolutely.
Thanks for being with us. Amar Madhani is a USA Today Chicago correspondent. Thanks for being with us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That does it for our show today. We're produced by Christine Herman, Austin Keating, and Travis Stansel. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Here's a song to get your weekend started early for Friday the 13th and the Cubs. Let's cheer them on. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.